Hi, I'm Tom Luna. I'm a former school board member. I was privileged to serve as senior advisor to U.S. Secretary of Education Rod Paige. I also had the honor of serving for 8 years as Idaho State Superintendent of Public Instruction. During that time, I also served as president of the Council of Chief State School Officers. One thing I have learned in all these experiences is that educating children is not rocket science. It's more complicated. On my podcast, Swimming Upstream, we will visit with courageous leaders who challenge the prevailing tide and inspire all of us to swim against the current. Let's jump in.
Welcome to another episode of Swimming Upstream. We're in season number 2, and we're continuing our opportunities to visit with state education leaders from across the country, and those that have had a huge impact in their state, but also have had quite an impact on education with students across the country. And today, our special guest is the superintendent of the great state of Utah, Sydney Dixon. And Sydney, thank you so much for being on Swimming Upstream.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Sydney, you and I have known each other a long time, and our paths have crossed a number of times. And me in Idaho and you as state superintendent in Utah, I remember a phrase that was often used and probably still is, and that's when Idaho sneezes, Utah gets a cold, or vice versa, right? It seems like we're integrated in many, many different ways. We have a lot of things in common. Appreciate you spending some time with us, and want to take a moment and talk just a little bit about your background. You've been state superintendent for about 7 years.
Yeah, that's correct.
Right. Yeah, that's a long tenure for state chiefs, especially appointed ones like yourself. And so congratulations on that. But you have a very unique background. I think I recall reading that you started in a 2-room school in rural Utah.
I did. As a young child, I attended school in a 2-room schoolhouse where my grandmother was my teacher. So kindergarten through 3rd grade and 4th through 6th grade in another room. And it was glorious and heavenly. And I am so grateful that I had that experience. I think it put me on a path to education and how it could really be personalized.
And how's that impacted as you look at Utah? It's a fast-growing state. But every state deals with the fact that we have large centers of population, but most every state also has a rural area, and education in rural America can be just as challenging at times as it is in urban and suburban America.
Yes. You know, it's all about resources, as you know, Tom. So in rural Utah, we have fabulous educators, and the school is the hub of the community. Everybody leans into supporting schools in our rural areas. And yet there's a perception that perhaps they don't have all the resources that they need. I think our kiddos in Utah really have access due to our digital efforts and other outreach efforts, concurrent enrollment. They can access a lot of courses that help them be on a path to success, whether it's in the workforce or post-secondary. The challenge is the number of personnel. So you have a small district or a charter school, and you have one person in charge of everything versus an urban or suburban setting where you have a district full or an office full of people to support programs. And I think that heavy lift in our rural communities is really the challenge. Personalization for education, I think, is sometimes easier in our rural settings, but the weight that our teachers and our administrators feel in rural America really are a challenge that we still haven't been able to quite conquer yet.
Yeah, those are great points. And Superintendent Dixon, you mentioned that one of the strategies for helping students in rural America, rural Utah, rural Idaho, wherever, to have equal access and equal opportunities, connectivity, a digital component to this. In Utah, for a long time, kind of flew under the radar and all of the great things that Utah was doing to really be a leader in the proper implementation of technology to enhance learning opportunities and really to give teachers more tools to teach with. I don't think it's a well-kept secret anymore. I think Utah's finally getting the credit they deserve. But talk to us about I guess the path that Utah took to get to where they are currently in the implementation of technology and devices. And then also, I want to make sure we spend some time talking about how, you know, nobody anticipated COVID happening, but it did. And we had this abrupt closure of schools, and states were scrambling to provide some kind of learning opportunities. And I think because of your forethought and efforts, Utah was probably the most prepared state in the country to deal with this. So first though, let's talk about just the history of Utah's engagement and embracement of technology in education.
Sure. I'll do that by backwards mapping a little bit. We have had people reach out and say, wow, Utah was the only state that did not decline. You held steady in eighth grade mathematics, according to NAEP, the nation's report card. How did you do that? Or you took a dip instead of a dive in some of your categories for fourth grade reading and math. So tell us about that. So that's today, backwards mapping then to about nine years ago, actually, when the conversations first started. We saw technology moving into our state as a viable sector for workforce. And we wanted to make sure that our kids could be part of that workforce. So we started meeting with legislators, technology leaders, and really talking about what would it look like to have a master plan for digital teaching and learning in Utah. And we consulted with those around the state who were doing some great work in this area, developed a master plan, the legislature put money behind it, and then we had a three-phase approach of digital teaching and learning grants. So our districts and charters could apply for a planning grant and then an implementation grant year two and three. And we found that time to plan to really look at infrastructure, professional learning for educators, the hardware that they needed, the connectivity that they needed, really being able to take time to assess all of that and put that together in a plan and implement that plan, then made us ready for the pandemic. Nobody was truly ready. It was not a great effort, but we were far ahead of many states because when we closed schools on Friday, Tuesday, we were ready to launch and have kids connect to their teachers by being able to get 70% of our kids online with devices in their hands. So our efforts during the pandemic were spent on that digital divide, getting at that other 30%.
Yeah, so part of the backbone of what you described is the Utah Education Network, which I think is, probably still is, not known enough. Idaho duplicated that. But the whole idea of having a managed intranet, right, which is used to deliver, it's really the highway, and then you can put all these different vehicles on this digital highway that you've created to connect schools and districts and families and stuff. But talk about the Utah Education Network and, you know, where it's housed, how it's operated, and how it's used.
We really are blessed to have the Utah Education Telehealth Network in our state. So it's combined with telehealth, which has made it more rich and robust and creates that sense of urgency. So it really is sort of the digital pipeline, if you will, throughout our state. The energy and efforts that are put into the UETN network provide security features for all of our schools. So every school is not going out and trying to find their own security system to make sure that kids are digitally safe. So there's the security part, there's the infrastructure of the networks. They also provide professional learning for our educators. They can scale up on software packages. So they can provide a lot of services for teachers and parents, actually, to be able to go into their system and choose items for lesson plans. We have all of our standards there. So it's really sort of this digital space that everyone can engage in. It's housed at the University of Utah. They support UETN with personnel. Again, there's funding from the legislature, but it's also connected to the university hospital system. So being able to provide telehealth, telemental health, so that integration has been a real powerful force in our state and enable us then to really do the plugins and the add-ons with our devices And then our communities still have to have connectivity and the internet, but they really have laid the pipeline, the infrastructure, yeah, and provide that backbone that you stated so well to help us be able to thrive on top of it.
It's kind of the last mile issue, right, that you talk about, where with the initial effort to get connectivity to the schools, then the pipeline then is in the community, and that makes it much more easier than to get healthcare and others connected to that pipeline once it's in the community. But that's that last mile is always the most difficult, and that's what was initially accomplished.
Right. Right. And if I could illustrate that last mile down in San Juan District, UETN has worked closely with San Juan. It's sort of that last mile. I love that, thinking about it that way, but it's a reality. So during the pandemic, we have the Navajo Nation, the highest rate of virus spread anywhere in our state for sure. And tribal leaders very concerned about just making sure that their elders stayed safe. So that meant we had to do things very differently. Buses going over rutted roads to deliver food, deliver paper packets. And even that became a situation that was concerning to tribal leaders of paper going back and forth touched by many hands. So we had to really think about our protocols. In the meantime, the technology leads in San Juan, along with tribal leaders, were figuring out a way to kind of take existing poles and radio technology and connect a deeper sense of technology, so better connectivity. And if you think about that Verizon commercial, "Can you hear me now?" They were literally walking through slot canyons with technology saying, "Can you hear me now?" and connecting. So I had the opportunity to go down and see a presentation where everything was going to be connected, get in a suburban with a lot of people and drive these rutted roads to the Klan house, to grandma's house, to see how it would all happen. And then go back to the school, the high school, to see a student connect with their teacher for the very first time. And that was just so life-changing to see and understand that so many kiddos had not been connected with an educator for almost a year in a face-to-face setting. They had been going to the Klan house and camping out or near a bus. We had Wi-Fi on buses, but to actually have it in their home and for their families to be able not only to connect to the school, but to connect with each other was a huge boost for our students down in San Juan County. And it helped them finally get connected. We're still needing to provide additional services to make sure our students get caught up to levels of learning that they were at before and beyond. But that was just a huge undertaking with all hands on deck to make sure that our students who live on the Navajo Nation were able to, or in the Navajo Nation, were able to connect with their schools.
Yeah, definitely some of the most needy, right, as you explained. And Cindy, I want to talk about a couple other things. But before we leave this topic, a number of states have worked to, you know, implement technology and have hit some roadblocks, some resistance. I don't think this is much the case anymore. But back when you were building this whole effort, you know, there was always this concern that was expressed that you're trying to replace teachers with a laptop or protecting students from intentional or unintentional exposure to bad things, right? That, you know, whether it's pornography or adults or something trying to communicate with them. But you navigated this, and you talked, before we jumped on the call here, you talked about, there was a process to engage everyone. And also you made a statement kind of to the fact that this wasn't an idea of just you having technology and it was kind of sitting over here. It was fully integrated part of the education experience. So talk to us about that, because I think you've navigated a path that others have tried and weren't as successful.
Yes, we think about digital teaching and learning. It's a tool. You know, I think of the old adage of the kindergarten teacher with the apron and a lot of pockets, and they've got something in every one of those pockets. Well, if you use that same analogy and think about all the tools that teachers have at their disposal, technology is one of those tools. So it should be integrated right into the classroom. And that took a lot of professional development for our teachers. And that's still ongoing today. You can't just put a device and assume that everybody knows how to use it. And kids are great at social media. Their noses are in their phones 24/7, but it doesn't mean they know how to use digital tools effectively. So whether you're using Google Classroom, we have some statewide initiatives. We use things like Nearpod, and there are a bunch of tools that teachers can use for formative assessments, for group work, individual work. And we see kids using it in group work individually, but the teacher is still central to the most effective instruction. It's how they use the technology. I think we still have some pockets where we put kids on a piece of software and aren't fully integrated into the overall schema. But now that we have a really robust literacy initiative, it's another way for us to lean in and say, all right, let's take another look at the software that's being used. Does it align with the science of reading? How do we integrate it into whole group and small group work? So we're always reassessing and reevaluating the tools that we have. There's some great products out there, but we want to make sure that they align with standards, that they're safe, that they're teaching, help support the right kinds of things that we're teaching in our standards, and really aid students in learning. That's the bottom line. Not taking over the learning, not taking over the teaching, but aiding our students in creating possibilities for their future.
That's wonderful. You mentioned your ability to lean in and do more when it comes to literacy. So let's talk about that early literacy and Utah's efforts and your kind of vision and goals and the impact that you and those programs have had on literacy, early literacy and those issues in Utah.
Well, we're unique in a couple of ways. Well, first of all, we have a lot of kids. I think we've got more children per capita than any other state. Idaho's probably right there with us.
Yeah, I'd say probably number two, but we're right there.
We could even toggle back and forth, but we have a lot of kiddos for sure. Kindergarten is not mandatory in our state, even though about 95% of our students attend. We haven't had access for all students to full-day kindergarten, so that's been one of our big efforts, really looking at our preschool services, kindergarten, making sure that more students have access. And it's a choice for our parents with full day K. But that's been a big lift that our legislature has been a great partner on. Second, we have been watching the work of Mississippi. And while they took a decade to get their work done, they've been amazing partners to say, we've learned all the lessons. You don't have to take a decade. Half of our kids were not reading at grade level by third grade. And that's just unconscionable. We've been working on it, talking about it, but we now know better. We have the science of reading. So again, partnering with our legislature to put a lot of funding into all of the elements. I think part of the problem is that somebody says, let's have coaches, or let's try this curriculum material, or let's use this strategy. And you have to do it all together. It's a community effort with families intimately involved with reading instruction. So we've leaned all in, and we're already seeing some great results between full day K and just a couple of years of our literacy initiative. Our kids are really on the move. We can see that we're maintaining the gaps, that those summer slides and gaps that used to happen with second grade. I think this is the first year we've seen those hold steady and keep moving forward. So we're really excited about the possibilities. And we really owe a lot of it to Mississippi, who has led out in our country, and we're all following suit.
Being able to address the summer slide, you know, and if you're making progress there, as Mississippi has, and I think you're exactly right. I think Mississippi is really has the blueprint that states can follow if they're serious. Well, they're all serious, but my point is if they want to take advantage of lessons learned in Mississippi and not experience them themselves, it's not going to take 10 years, right? You can start seeing results a lot sooner. So appreciate that example that Utah has been there. Talk to us about, you know, literacy is always the foundation of all of this. But if you have more and more students that are moving through school and they have that foundation of literacy, then you can create many more opportunities for them as they enter into middle school and even high school. And one of the things that you've worked on is, you know, these durable skills and workforce readiness efforts. Talk to us about what Utah is doing in that lane. A lot of conversations around the country about the need for that. Not a new conversation either, right? But again, figuring out how to actually do it and accomplish it with success. So talk to us about your efforts and Utah's efforts in Utah around durable skills and workforce readiness.
One of the most exciting things that I've been involved in a long time is our Utah Portrait of a Graduate work. About 5 years ago, we started having people come together talking about what would it look like if we truly had this system where students leave our K-12 education system in Utah, and they are really prepared to succeed and lead. So our board developed a strategic plan with four goals around digital teaching and learning. Actually was part of that, but it was part of a bigger structure of early learning, effective teachers and leaders, safe and healthy schools, and personalized learning. So with those four goals, we put strategies behind that and then started doing the work of developing this portrait of a graduate. We brought stakeholders together from very diverse backgrounds all over the state, trying to get rural, urban perspectives from teachers, from students, from families, from business leaders. And that led to our portrait of a graduate, which is based on a roadmap or map. So it's mastery of those skills, like we talked about. Those are fundamental to everything: literacy, mathematics, science, social studies, civic education, financial literacy.
Yes.
So digital, financial, and civic literacy all embedded in that mastery space. And then the A of the map is autonomy. And that's some of those durable skills of critical thinking, communication, collaboration. You know, when you look at the work that's come out of NCEE, the National Council of Education and the Economy, I'm not sure what that C is, but NCEE, a great organization, they reported recently that the number one reason that 18 to 24-year-olds lose their jobs and they're turning over frequently in some of their jobs, it's the lack of those durable skills. And so really learning those in that autonomy, learning to be an autonomous learner and a lifelong learner through those durable skills. And then the P of our map is purpose. We want students to be empathic. We want them to engage in service learning. We want them to care for one another and not only love America, but love the Americans that live there. So really, really integrating with one another to try and learn one another's perspective so that we can turn down the heat in our country and all lean in to make America a wonderful country that it is. So those are all of the things that are embedded in our portrait of a graduate, but those durable skills that we've often just put in that career and technical education bucket. And I will say that I believe we're the only state that requires a credit of career and technical education to graduate. So we've had this really strong CTE program for a long time, but how do we modernize it? And how do we ensure that those durable skills cut across all of our content areas? That's the challenge and the promise of our Utah Portrait of a Graduate that's getting some national recognition.
So when you look at students reacting to this in high school, what are some of the things you're seeing? I said before, probably too many times, even on these podcasts, so this won't be anything new to people who have watched these in the past, but when students see relevance to what they're learning, rigor will take care of itself, right?
Right.
But if students don't see relevance, it's very tough for them to get them to perform at their highest levels, right? But when they see relevance, then they just want more and more of it because they see the need for it. So how are students, when they see the portrait of the graduate, how is it presented to them in a way that they see the relevance to this or it creates the relevance for the work that they're doing?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it's only as good as it's played out in the classroom and the culture of the school, right? So
yeah.
Ours is an aspirational document. It was never meant to be forced on the entire state or have everyone adopt it, but we hope that it will be adapted or looked at as a model. And so where we see communities rising up and replicating the work, meaning bringing everybody together, including students, to talk about in their local community context, what does it mean for them? You might see some other things be embedded of cultural relevance to their community. So it takes on a life of its own when you have the students engaged in and their voice, they can see it in their in the portrait, in their district or their charter. So we're starting to see that work take root. What we're really working on is to move away from the three B's that have driven us forever, bells, buses, and bottom time or seat time. And so thinking more about competencies, and I think that's where the relevance comes in. When students can see a standard, they know what it looks like to fully engage with that standard and complete the standard, and then be able to move on, either go deeper or move on to something else that becomes relevant to them. So that's the angle that we're using, or the entry point, if you will, and that's getting away from everybody doing the same thing and checking it off like cookie cutter, but rather moving at pace. Space and time is a variable, you know, in terms of like the learning is the constant. Space, place, time, all of those things are the variables.
And it used to be just the opposite, right? And that's what you're talking about, is just flipping that, right?
Yeah. And students are excited about that. So in Utah, you might stay at home and take a course online. You might be enrolled in a college course at the community college, a tech center. We have a great embedded tech college and university system that's all one together. So I could engage in what we call stackable credentials. And our goal is to have students graduate high school with their first credential. So I'm leaving high school with a credential that allows me to be fully employed. At the same time, I can continue to build on those credentials. And that's the K-16 system that we're trying to provide for students. So they can not only find themselves and find their passion, but realize that there are many ways that that can go. It's not like when you and I, Tom, although we're still kids, when we started, the world was about a career.
Yeah.
You started on a path and you might wind through that pathway of education like I have for 42 years, like you have. But kids nowadays could go from medicine to education to engineering. You know, like they have this world ahead of them where they have to be very nimble. So learning those skills, those durable skills, and being able to navigate with mastery of content and move through a way of credentialing and micro-credentialing, I think is an exciting new world. And then you put artificial intelligence on top of that.
That's another whole conversation, isn't it? And that we could talk about. But Sydney, you made great points. The world that our children are graduating into is far different than the one that we graduated into. And most if not all of the students that are graduating, and even the, you know, the generation above them, never, they have no intention of having one career their whole life. They want to do multiple things. And so having the education background to be able to do that is what is the life that they want to live. You know, that's what they want their careers to be like. And we have to make sure our education system is meeting those demands and those needs. So really appreciate your vision, and not only the vision, but the things you actually accomplished, right? And that's the tough part in education, is actually getting the water to the end of the row, right? And you and I, we grew up in farming communities and stuff, and we know what that means, right? We've got to get the water to the end of the row. But really appreciate your time here on Swimming Upstream. Appreciate your leadership, not just in Utah, but across the country, where you continue to be involved in boards and leadership that have impact in many, many other states. But before we let you go, we always ask our guests to share with us one piece of trivia or fact about your state, Utah, that most people wouldn't be aware of.
Oh, goodness. So many trivial points. I will share a couple. One, the TV was invented here in Utah, television by Viola T. Farnsworth. And second, I think we are still the number one consumer of ice cream. That's the sugar. We definitely love our sugar here in Utah. And we tried to raise sugarcane. It didn't, or through sugar beets and sugarcane didn't work so well back when the valley was settled. But I think we are still high consumers of sugar.
Oh, what fascinating. Well, my memory, you know, because we go through Utah a lot, is they have some amazing ice cream places there. I think Cold Stone started in Utah, didn't it? You know?
Yes, we have at least four or five that I can think of ice cream brands, and ice cream trucks are everywhere. So come to Utah if you want great ice cream.
And watch TV while you're enjoying the ice cream. Yeah, there you go. Well, Cindy Dixon, State Superintendent of Public Instruction for the great state and our sister state here in Idaho, but the great state of Utah. Thank you for being on Swimming Upstream, and thank you for all the great work you do for students in Utah and across the country.
Tom, thank you so much for being a mentor to me and to so many new state chiefs. You have been great to be the first to reach out to all of us, so we really appreciate you. Thank you for setting the standard.
Well, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening. And remember, our children may only be 22% of our population, but they represent 100% of our future. If you found this conversation valuable, subscribe to our YouTube channel and find us on your favorite podcast platform. Swimming Upstream is part of the Strategos Podcast Network. To view the entire lineup of our shows, visit our website, strategosgroup.com. Hi, I'm Tom Luna. I'm a former school board member. I was privileged to serve as senior advisor to U.S. Secretary of Education Rod Paige. I also had the honor of serving for 8 years as Idaho State Superintendent of Public Instruction. During that time, I also served as president of the Council of Chief State School Officers. One thing I have learned in all these experiences is that educating children is not rocket science. It's more complicated. On my podcast, Swimming Upstream, we will visit with courageous leaders who challenge the prevailing tide and inspire all of us to swim against the current. Let's jump in.
Welcome to another episode of Swimming Upstream. We're in season number 2, and we're continuing our opportunities to visit with state education leaders from across the country, and those that have had a huge impact in their state, but also have had quite an impact on education with students across the country. And today, our special guest is the superintendent of the great state of Utah, Cindy Dixon. And Cindy, thank you so much for being on Swimming Upstream.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Cindy, you and I have known each other a long time, and our paths have crossed a number of times. And me in Idaho and you as state superintendent in Utah, I remember a phrase that was often used and probably still is, and that's when Idaho sneezes, Utah gets a cold, or vice versa, right? It seems like we're integrated in many, many different ways. We have a lot of things in common. But appreciate you spending some time with us, and want to take a moment and talk just a little bit about your background. You've been state superintendent for about 7 years.
Yeah, that's correct.
Right. Yeah, that's a long tenure for state chiefs, especially appointed ones like yourself. And so congratulations on that. But you have a very unique background. I think I recall reading that you started in a 2-room school in rural Utah.
I did. As a young child, I attended school in a 2-room schoolhouse where my grandmother was my teacher. So kindergarten through third grade and 4th through 6th grade in another room. And it was glorious and heavenly. And I am so grateful that I had that experience. I think it put me on a path to education and how it could really be personalized.
And how's that impacted as you look at Utah? It's a fast growing state. But every state deals with the fact that we have large centers of population, but most every state also has a rural area, and education in rural America can be just as challenging at times as it is in urban and suburban America.
Yes. You know, it's all about resources, as you know, Tom. So in rural Utah, we have fabulous educators, and the school is the hub of the community. Everybody leans into supporting schools in our rural areas. And yet there's a perception that perhaps they don't have all the resources that they need. I think our kiddos in Utah really have access, due to our digital efforts, and other outreach efforts, concurrent enrollment, they can access a lot of courses that help them be on a path to success, whether it's in the workforce or post-secondary. The challenge is the number of personnel. So you have a small district or a charter school, and you have one person in charge of everything versus an urban or suburban setting where you have a district full or an office full of people to support programs. And I think that heavy lift in our rural communities is really the challenge. Personalization for education, I think, is sometimes easier in our rural settings, but the weight that our teachers and our administrators feel in rural America really are a challenge that we still haven't been able to quite conquer yet.
Yeah, those are great points. And Superintendent Dixon, you mentioned that one of the strategies for helping students in rural America, rural Utah, rural Idaho, wherever, to have equal access and equal opportunities, connectivity, a digital, there is a digital component to this. In Utah, for a long time, kind of flew under the radar and all of the great things that Utah was doing to really be a leader in the proper implementation of technology to enhance learning opportunities and really to give teachers more tools to teach with. I don't think it's a well-kept secret anymore. I think Utah's finally getting the credit they deserve. But talk to us about, I guess, the path that Utah took to get to where they are currently in the implementation of technology and devices. And then also, I want to make sure we spend some time talking about how, nobody anticipated COVID happening, but it did. And we had this abrupt closure of schools, and states were scrambling to provide some kind of learning opportunities. And I think because of your forethought and efforts, Utah was probably the most prepared state in the country to deal with this. So first though, let's talk about just the history of Utah's engagement and embracement of technology in education.
Sure. I'll do that by backwards mapping a little bit. We have had people reach out and say, wow, Utah was the only state that did not decline. You held steady in eighth grade mathematics, according to NAEP, the nation's report card. How did you do that? Or you took a dip instead of a dive in some of your categories for fourth grade reading and math. So tell us about that. So that's today, backwards mapping then to about nine years ago, actually, when the conversations first started. We saw technology moving into our state as a viable sector for workforce. And we wanted to make sure that our kids could be part of that workforce. So we started meeting with legislators, technology leaders, and really talking about what would it look like to have a master plan for digital teaching and learning in Utah. And we consulted with those around the state who were doing some great work in this area, developed a master plan, the legislature put money behind it, and then we had a three-phase approach of digital teaching and learning grants. So our districts and charters could apply for a planning grant and then an implementation grant year two and three. And we found that time to plan to really look at infrastructure, professional learning for educators, the hardware that they needed, the connectivity that they needed, really being able to take time to assess all of that and put that together in a plan and implement that plan, then made us ready for the pandemic. Nobody was truly ready. It was not a great effort, but we were far ahead of many states because when we closed schools on Friday, Tuesday, we were ready to launch and have kids connect to their teachers by being able to get 70% of our kids online with devices in their hands. So our efforts during the pandemic were spent on that digital divide, getting at that other 30%.
Yeah. So part of the backbone of what you described is the Utah Education Network, which I think is, probably still is, not known enough. Idaho duplicated that. But the whole idea of having a managed intranet, right, which is used to deliver. It's really the highway, and then you can put all these different vehicles on this digital highway that you've created to connect schools and districts and families and stuff. But talk about the Utah Education Network and, you know, where it's housed, how it's operated, and how it's used.
We really are blessed to have the Utah Education Telehealth Network in our state. So it's combined with telehealth, which has made it more rich and robust and creates that sense of urgency. So it really is sort of the digital pipeline, if you will, throughout our state. The energy and efforts that are put into the UETN network provide security features for all of our schools. So every school is not going out and trying to find their own security system to make sure that kids are digitally safe. So there's the security part, there's the infrastructure of the networks. They also provide professional learning for our educators. They can scale up on software packages, so they can provide a lot of services for teachers and parents, actually, to be able to go into their system and choose items for lesson plans. We have all of our standards there. So it's really sort of this digital space that everyone can engage in. It's housed at the University of Utah. They support UETN with personnel. Again, there's funding from the legislature, but it's also connected to the university hospital system. So being able to provide telehealth, telemental health. So that integration has been a real powerful force in our state and enable us then to really do the plugins and the add-ons with our devices. And then our communities still have to have connectivity in the internet, but they really have laid the pipeline, the infrastructure, yeah, and provide that backbone that you stated so well to help us be able to thrive on top of it.
It's kind of the last mile issue, right, that you talk about, where with the initial effort to get connectivity to the schools, then the pipeline then is in the community, and that makes it much more easier than to get healthcare and others connected to that pipeline once it's in the community. But that's that last mile is always the most difficult, and that's what was initially accomplished.
Right. Right. And if I could illustrate that last mile down in San Juan District, UETN has worked closely with San Juan. It's sort of that last mile. I love that, thinking about it that way, but it's a reality. So during the pandemic, we have the Navajo Nation, the highest rate of virus spread anywhere in our state for sure. And tribal leaders very concerned about just making sure that their elders stayed safe. So that meant we had to do things very differently. Buses going over rutted roads to deliver food, deliver paper packets. And even that became a situation that was concerning to tribal leaders, of paper going back and forth, touched by many hands. So we had to really think about our protocols. In the meantime, the technology leads in San Juan, along with tribal leaders, were figuring out a way to kind of take existing poles and radio technology and connect a deeper sense of technology, so better connectivity. And if you think about that Verizon commercial, "Can you hear me now?" They were literally walking through slot canyons with technology saying, "Can you hear me now?" and connecting. So I had the opportunity to go down and see a presentation where everything was going to be connected, get in a suburban with a lot of people and drive these rutted roads to the Klan house, to grandma's house, to see how it would all happen, and then go back to the school, the high school, to see a student connect with their teacher for the very first time. And that was just so life-changing to see and understand that so many kiddos had not been connected with an educator for almost a year in a face-to-face setting. They had been going to the Klan house and camping out or near a bus. We had Wi-Fi on buses, but to actually have it in their home and for their families to be able not only to connect to the school, but to connect with each other was a huge boost for our students down in San Juan County. And it helped them finally get connected. We're still needing to provide additional services to make sure our students get caught up to levels of learning that they were at before and beyond. But that was just a huge undertaking with all hands on deck to make sure that our students who live on the Navajo Nation were able to, or in the Navajo Nation, were able to connect with their schools.
Yeah, definitely some of the most needy, right, as you explained. And Cindy, I want to talk about a couple other things. But before we leave this topic, a number of states have worked to, you know, implement technology and have hit some roadblocks, some resistance. I don't think this is much the case anymore. But back when you were building this whole effort, you know, there was always this concern that was expressed that you're trying to replace teachers with a laptop or protecting students from intentional or unintentional exposure to bad things, right? That, you know, whether it's pornography or adults or something trying to communicate with them. But you navigated this, and you talked, before we jumped on the call here, you talked about, there was a process to engage everyone. And also you made a statement kind of to the fact that this wasn't an idea of just you having technology and it was kind of sitting over here. It was fully integrated part of the education experience. So talk to us about that, because I think you've navigated a path that others have tried and weren't as successful.
Yes, we think about digital teaching and learning. It's a tool. You know, I think of the old adage of the kindergarten teacher with the apron and a lot of pockets, and they've got something in every one of those pockets. Well, if you use that same analogy and think about all the tools that teachers have at their disposal, technology is one of those tools. So it should be integrated right into the classroom. And that took a lot of professional development for our teachers. And that's still ongoing today. You can't just put a device and assume that everybody knows how to use it. And kids are great at social media. Their noses are in their phones 24/7, but it doesn't mean they know how to use digital tools effectively. So whether you're using Google Classroom, we have some statewide initiatives. We use things like Nearpod, and there are a bunch of tools that teachers can use for formative assessments, for group work, individual work. And we see kids using it in group work, individually, but the teacher is still central to the most effective instruction. It's how they use the technology. I think we still have some pockets where we put kids on a piece of software and aren't fully integrated into the overall schema. But now that we have a really robust literacy initiative, it's another way for us to lean in and say, all right, let's take another look at the software that's being used. Does it align with the science of reading? How do we integrate it into whole group and small group work? So we're always reassessing and reevaluating the tools that we have. There's some great products out there, but we want to make sure that they align with standards, that they're safe, that yes, they're teaching, that help support the right kinds of things that we're teaching in our standards, and really aid students in learning. That's the bottom line. Not taking over the learning, not taking over the teaching, but aiding our students in creating possibilities for their future.
That's wonderful. You mentioned your ability to lean in and do more when it comes to literacy. So let's talk about that. Early literacy and Utah's efforts and your kind of vision and goals and the impact that you and those programs have had on literacy, early literacy and those issues in Utah.
Well, we're unique in a couple of ways. Well, first of all, we have a lot of kids. I think we've got more children per capita than any other state. Idaho's probably right there with us.
Yeah, I'd say probably number two, but we're right there.
We could even toggle back and forth. But we have a lot of kiddos, for sure. Kindergarten is not mandatory in our state, even though about 95% of our students attend. We haven't had access for all students to full-day kindergarten, so that's been one of our big efforts, really looking at our preschool services, kindergarten, making sure that more students have access. And it's a choice for our parents with full-day K, but that's been a big lift that our legislature has been a great partner on. Second, we have been watching the work of Mississippi. And while they took a decade to get their work done, they've been amazing partners to say, we've learned all the lessons. You don't have to take a decade. Half of our kids were not reading at grade level by third grade. And that's just unconscionable. We've been working on it, talking about it, but we now know better. We have the science of reading. So again, partnering with our legislature to put a lot of funding into all of the elements. I think part of the problem is that somebody says, let's have coaches, or let's try this curriculum material, or let's use this strategy. And you have to do it all together. It's a community effort with families intimately involved with reading instruction. So we've leaned all in, and we're already seeing some great results between full day K and just a couple of years of our literacy initiative. Our kids are really on the move. We can see that we're maintaining the gaps, that those summer slides and gaps that used to happen with second grade. I think this is the first year we've seen those hold steady and keep moving forward. So we're really excited about the possibilities. And we really owe a lot of it to Mississippi, who has led out in our country, and we're all following suit.
Being able to address the summer slide, you know, and if you're making progress there, as Mississippi has, and I think you're exactly right. I think Mississippi is really has the blueprint that states can follow if they're serious. Well, they're all serious, but my point is if they want to take advantage of lessons learned in Mississippi and not experience them themselves, it's not going to take 10 years, right? You can start seeing results a lot sooner. So appreciate that example that Utah has been there. Talk to us about, you know, literacy is always the foundation of all of this, but if you have more and more students that are moving through school and they have that foundation of literacy, then you can create many more opportunities for them as they enter into middle school and even high school. And one of the things that you've worked on is, you know, these durable skills and workforce readiness efforts. Talk to us about what Utah is doing in that lane. A lot of conversations around the country about the need for that. Not a new conversation either, right? But again, figuring out how to actually do it and accomplish it with success. So talk to us about your efforts and Utah's efforts in Utah around durable skills and workforce readiness.
One of the most exciting things that I've been involved in a long time is our Utah Portrait of a Graduate work. About 5 years ago, we started having people come together talking about what would it look like if we truly had this system where students leave our K-12 education system in Utah, and they are really prepared to succeed and lead. So our board developed a strategic plan with four goals around digital teaching and learning. Actually was part of that, but it was part of a bigger structure of early learning, effective teachers and leaders, safe and healthy schools, and personalized learning. So with those four goals, we put strategies behind that and then started doing the work of developing this portrait of a graduate. We brought stakeholders together from very diverse backgrounds all over the state, trying to get rural, urban perspectives from teachers, from students, from families, from business leaders. And that led to our Portrait of a Graduate, which is based on a roadmap or map. So it's mastery of those skills, like we talked about. Those are fundamental to everything: literacy, mathematics, science, social studies, civic education, financial literacy.
Yes.
So digital, financial, and civic literacy all embedded in that mastery space. And then the A of the map is autonomy. And that's some of those durable skills of critical thinking, communication, collaboration. You know, when you look at the work that's come out of NCEE, the National Council of Education and the Economy, I'm not sure what that C is, but NCEE, a great organization. They reported recently that the number one reason that 18 to 24 year olds lose their jobs and they're turning over frequently in some of their jobs, it's the lack of those durable skills. And so really learning those in that autonomy, learning to be an autonomous learner and a lifelong learner through those durable skills. And then the P of our map is purpose. We want students to be empathic. We want them to engage in service learning. We want them to care for one another and not only love America, but love the Americans that live there. So really, really integrating with one another to try and learn one another's perspective so that we can turn down the heat in our country and all lean in to make America a wonderful country that it is. So those are all of the things that are embedded in our Portrait of a Graduate, but those durable skills that we've often just put in that career and technical education bucket And I will say that I believe we're the only state that requires a credit of career and technical education to graduate. So we've had this really strong CTE program for a long time. But how do we modernize it? And how do we ensure that those durable skills cut across all of our content areas? That's the challenge and the promise of our Utah Portrait of a Graduate that's getting some national recognition.
So when you look at students reacting to this in high school, what are some of the things you're seeing? I said before, probably too many times, even on these podcasts, so this won't be anything new to people who have watched these in the past, but when students see relevance to what they're learning, rigor will take care of itself, right?
Right.
But if students don't see relevance, it's very tough for them to get them to perform at their highest levels, right? But when they see relevance, then they just want more and more of it because they see the need for it. So how are students, when they see the portrait of the graduate, how is it presented to them in a way that they see the relevance to this or it creates the relevance for the work that they're doing?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it's only as good as it's played out in the classroom and the culture of the school, right? So
yeah.
Ours is an aspirational document. It was never meant to be forced on the entire state or have everyone adopt it, but we hope that it will be adapted or looked at as a model. And so where we see communities rising up and replicating the work, meaning bringing everybody together, including students, to talk about in their local community context, what does it mean for them? You might see some other things be embedded of cultural relevance to their community. So it takes on a life of its own when you have the students engaged in and their voice, they can see it in their in the portrait, in their district or their charter. So we're starting to see that work take root. What we're really working on is to move away from the three B's that have driven us forever, bells, buses, and bottom time or seat time. And so thinking more about competencies, and I think that's where the relevance comes in. When students can see a standard, they know what it looks like to fully engage with that standard and complete the standard, and then be able to move on, either go deeper or move on to something else that becomes relevant to them. So that's the angle that we're using, or the entry point, if you will, and that's getting away from everybody doing the same thing and checking it off like cookie cutter, but rather moving at pace. Space and time is a variable, you know, in terms of, like, the learning is the constant. Space, place, time, all of those things are the variables.
And it used to be just the opposite, right? And that's what you're talking about, is just flipping that, right?
Yeah, and students are excited about that. So in Utah, you might stay at home and take a course online. You might be enrolled in a college course at the community college, a tech center. We have a great embedded tech college and university system that's all one together. So I could engage in what we call stackable credentials. And our goal is to have students graduate high school with their first credential. So I'm leaving high school with a credential that allows me to be fully employed. At the same time, I can continue to build on those credentials. And that's the K-16 system that we're trying to provide for students. So they can not only find themselves and find their passion, but realize that there are many ways that that can go. It's not like when you and I, Tom, although we're still kids, when we started, the world was about a career.
Yeah.
You started on a path and you might wind through that pathway of education like I have for 42 years, like you have. But kids nowadays could go from medicine to education to engineering. You know, like they have this world ahead of them where they have to be very nimble. So learning those skills, those durable skills, and being able to navigate with mastery of content and move through a way of credentialing and micro-credentialing, I think is an exciting new world. And then you put artificial intelligence on top of that.
That's another whole conversation, isn't it? And that we could talk about. But Sydney, you made great points. The world that our children are graduating into is far different than the one that we graduated into. And most, if not all, of the students that are graduating, and even the generation above them, they have no intention of having one career their whole life. They want to do multiple things, And so having the education background to be able to do that is what is the life that they want to live. You know, that's what they want their careers to be like. And we have to make sure our education system is meeting those demands and those needs. So really appreciate your vision, and not only the vision, but the things you actually accomplished, right? And that's the tough part in education, is actually getting the water to the end of the row, right? And you and I, we grew up in farming communities and stuff, and we know what that means, right? We've got to get the water to the end of the row. But really appreciate your time here on Swimming Upstream. Appreciate your leadership, not just in Utah, but across the country, where you continue to be involved in boards and leadership that have impact in many, many other states. But before we let you go, we always ask our guests to share with us one piece of trivia or fact about your state, Utah, that most people wouldn't be aware of.
Oh, goodness. So many trivia points. I will share a couple. One, the TV was invented here in Utah, television, by Viola T. Farnsworth. And second, I think we are still the number one consumer of ice cream. That's sugar. We definitely love our sugar here in Utah. And we tried to raise sugar cane. It didn't, or through sugar beets and sugar cane, didn't work so well back when the valley was settled. But I think we are still high consumers of sugar.
Oh, what fascinating. Well, my memory, you know, because we go through Utah a lot, is they have some amazing ice cream places there. I think Cold Stone started in Utah, didn't it? You know?
Yes, we have four or five that I can think of ice cream brands, and ice cream trucks are everywhere. So come to Utah if you want great ice cream.
And watch TV while you're enjoying the ice cream. Yeah, there you go. Well, Cindy Dixon, State Superintendent of Public Instruction for the great state and our sister state here in Idaho, but the great state of Utah. Thank you for being on Swimming Upstream, and thank you for all the great work you do for students in Utah and across the country.
Tom, thank you so much for being a mentor to me and to so many new state chiefs. You have been great to be the first to reach out to all of us, so we really appreciate you. Thank you for setting the standard.
Well, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening. And remember, our children may only be 22% of our population, but they represent 100% of our future. If you found this conversation valuable, subscribe to our YouTube channel and find us on your favorite podcast platform. Swimming Upstream is part of the Strategos Podcast Network. To view the entire lineup of our shows, visit our website, strategosgroup.com.